Now, I see here from my calendar notes that the county and CAPMC have elected to split 7.5 minutes. I'm not sure that we can put a half minute. Oh, we can? I've never. I was going to round up for your benefit, so let's go ahead and do that. I've never had such a request to split a minute before. Why don't we round it up to 8 minutes when appellees counsel stand up then?
Precision timing, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Timothy Scott. On behalf of the appellants, the estate of Callie Gary, as well as her surviving minor children. We're here on appeal because we allege that the First Amended complaint before the district court and the magistrate court did in fact state plausible claims for relief that certainly at the pleading stage should have sufficed to allow the case to go forward.
Counsel, you make a number of arguments in the pleadings, and so I want to focus you on one that as I think you might be making, but I'm not sure, and that's why I want you to clarify this for me today. What I believe you might be alleging is that the defendants placed Callie in danger by sending her to a clinic known to give appointment information to the abuser and did nothing to remedy it. That's what I see you might be alleging. But attach the allegation to that sort of claim. I mean, what did you allege in the complaint that satisfies that? How is it that they did that?
Well, the truth is that we don't have specific facts that they had specific notice.
Well, are bare allegations enough, counsel?
Well, we did allege constructive knowledge. We did allege that they should have known, even if they did not know, because of the heightened risk of not just danger to abused persons.
Yeah, that's the problem, counsel. First, I want to acknowledge that, you know, it's the facts are very tragic and sympathetic. But when we're talking about sufficiency of the allegations, you're going on a state-created danger claim. And so I don't think it's enough to just say that the shelter helped her secure the medical appointment, for example, because there's the but-for test, that but-for their conduct in helping her leave the house and stay in the shelter, and but-for their assistance in getting the appointment, she wouldn't have faced the same danger. And so I think given the way you crafted your theories in this case, I don't think the bare-bones allegation of just helping her secure shelter and the appointment is enough. And then as to your point about the actual and constructive knowledge, there is that bare allegation there. But as I'm sure you know, under Twombly and Iqbal, we don't accept legal conclusions as true. And because they're entities, just like any institution or agency or county, their knowledge can only be through their agents and employees. And I didn't see any allegations of employees. Okay, so you can say the county knew or should have known, but how? Even for Rule 8 purposes, right, for an entity to have knowledge, there has to be some allegation that a person and not an entity's response or county is responsible for that. So can you help me with those questions?
Yes, Your Honor, I will try. I don't know that we only made bare factual allegations. Some of the specific factual allegations that we had are the specific notice about this particular third party, the enraged husband, and the specific threats that he had made against Ms. Gary.
Right. I didn't mean to suggest that there weren't more specific allegations as to what she faced. I'm talking about specific allegations as to the county and CAPMC's role.
Right. So CAPMC was apparently run at that time, or at least had a supervisor, someone in a supervisor capacity by name of Tina Rodriguez. And Ms. Rodriguez was the person that accompanied Ms. Gary to a restraining order hearing in which she herself perceived Mr. Gary making threats, being violent, would have perceived firsthand an enhanced risk of him carrying out the retribution that he had already promised and that CAPMC was aware of. It was after that, knowing that there was that specific risk from him, that we allege that they sought healthcare treatment offsite at this clinic, and that they transported Ms. Gary in a way, in a easily recognizable van, with an unarmed security person, and also a person who was 6 months on the job and just not in a position to provide any meaningful protection to Ms. Gary. They did make a deliberate choice to do that. Now, did they know that on that specific day and time, Mr. Gary would be there? Again,
but without... Did they have any policy? I mean, how do you establish the policy?
So the policy is tricky for us, honestly, particularly with CAPMC.
That's kind of an important part, counsel.
Well, the reason is, Your Honor, CAPMC is a government actor for purposes of 1983. At least that's what the court below found, although I know they challenged that at appeal, on appeal. We think properly so, that they were at least standing in the shoes of a public entity. But unlike a classic or an actual public entity, they're not susceptible or responsive to PRA requests, for example. We can't do records requests. We don't have the same government transparency to see what exactly their policies, their training programs, and such. Contrast that to a police department, for example, where their policies and procedures and their use of force.
Well, I understand how it's frustrating and maybe difficult, but we have to find that, though, in this case, that they had a policy.
Well, if that's one way, or the absence of a policy.
Okay.
And I say it that way because there is also supervision and there is also lack of training. So it is true that we're sort of trying to our best to extrapolate backwards from the result and from what happened and what we do know pre-discovery and without the aid of Public Records Act or government transparency that we would otherwise have.
So you don't have that in the you don't have that in the complaint though.
What we allege is the best that we could, which is that there is an absence of effective policies and procedures, that there was a lack of supervision.
And on knowledge, no indication that they knew the clinic gives out information.
Not specifically. No, that's true.
And don't you have to have that?
I don't know that we have to have that. What I would point to is...
You don't. Isn't it just a legal conclusion?
Well, I'm thinking of the Kennedy versus City of Ridgefield case, for example, which was also cited in the Mergia case, where it says that the exact harm or the exact nature of the harm that befalls the ultimate person at the or the victim at the hands of the third party doesn't need to be precisely foreseeable. Rather, it's the danger that person poses overall.
And you make the allegation, and here's the thing, and this is the sort of confusing and maybe the question I guess I have. You indicate in the allegation, and that's at ER 231, you indicate the county CAPMC knew from prior instances that the risk would jeopardize the health and safety of abuser, spouse, and children. Where do you come up with, I mean, how is that just, you think that might have happened from prior instances, or how do you know that? Well, or why do you allege that? How do you allege that?
One of our more specific factual allegations is that Tina Rodriguez was fired essentially immediately after this incident. And this came out in the criminal trial is the reason we were able to allege it in the complaint, is that she was fired for incompetence, quote unquote, and for dishonesty as well. And so, again, we're doing the best we can with the record that we have, but it does, in our mind at least, lend credence to being able to allege on information of belief that there were prior instances that Ms. Rodriguez...
Based on what? She was fired?
Well, in the specific allegations of dishonesty and incompetence. So I would, I mean, that her job is to...
Right, relatedly, if I recall correctly, the district court granted the motion to dismiss with leave to amend, and you chose to stand on the plate because what we have is the best that you have.
That's the reality. That's the reality. I mean, I certainly would have amended if we had more vivid and specific facts at our disposal, but we put our best foot forward in the complaint. And as I say, I think under a supervision theory, under a failure to train theory, we don't actually have to allege prior prior instances if the specific risk is imminent enough or is foreseeable enough, predictable enough is the word I'm looking for, that that the failure to do so would likely result in harm under the circumstances. So I guess I say that in response to, do we have a prior pattern of conduct? We don't in this case, but the risk is enough.
You're hoping to get to discovery to find out one way or the other.
There's truth in that. And I think that given the fact that there is case law, City of Canton and Connick, the Supreme Court cases that say that one instance can be enough in some circumstances, we do feel that this is that case because of how serious the risk was, how foreseeable it was under the circumstances. And in that situation, under a training theory and under a supervision theory, we don't actually have to allege.
Just to make sure I understand, so you're saying this is the rare case under Connick, even though there are no allegations because you didn't know at the time that the defendants actually knew that the clinic had given out the appointment information to the husband?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Or that there is the risk of that happening. Okay. I mean, I would acknowledge that if they actually knew that he was going to be there on that date and time, I mean, just sort of extending the good faith to decent people, that they wouldn't have brought her there. But it's more the deliberate indifference to the risk of that happening because of systems or the lack of systems. I know I'm running a little short and want to at least reserve some time for rebuttal, but paragraph 79 and 80 in our complaint, which is at ER 229, describes a memo that went out to essentially all healthcare providers, but also county welfare providers, and I think a fair inference is that it would have gone to a battered woman shelter as well, because it's exactly what we're talking about, describing the specific risk of when an abused person seeks medical care, specifically through Medi-Cal in that situation, because that can generate, in that particular memo, an explanation of benefits, which will go back to the home, to the abuser, and give notice in really a general way or a more general way than this case of the facility at which that person is receiving care. And so it's that sort of notice that we point to, not as a prior act per se or a prior disaster that happened, but rather a very specific warning when a person is removed from the home or removes themselves from the home and then is seeking medical care, that act of receiving medical care can generate information that goes back to the abuser, and that's an incredibly serious risk that needs to be guarded against on a systemic level, on a training level, on a supervisory level. And it's our position.
I mean, you recognize that if we agree with you and send this back and this goes to a jury and there's this massive verdict, there'd be a huge incentive for counties and government officials to just completely avoid victims of domestic abuse. Why would they, I mean, if this is the kind of liability that they're going to incur, then why would they even, they'd never want to help these people to take on that risk?
Well, we would assume that they would want to try to help people in good faith the way that they are now. It's just that they have to do it
perfectly.
Not perfectly. No, I wouldn't say that. But competently and not recklessly ignoring clear and present danger that does exist. So I think in terms of a floodgates argument, the deliberate indifference standard is a significant.
I mean, if I were advising a county, I would say close down the shelters. Let's not take on the risk of helping these victims because, you know, you miss a phone call or, you know, we hire an incompetent person who doesn't show up for work on the right day and we get an intern to drive somebody to an appointment and then violence ensues. We're all going to be liable.
Right. And I guess my response was that I would advise them, keep doing what you're doing, but do it better and improve the training programs and improve the supervision so that we can do what we're doing, but do it safely. With that, I'll reserve my 50 seconds. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Timothy Buchanan on behalf of the County of Madera. May it please the Court. I believe the panel has touched on the nerve center of the problem here, and that is a lack of connection of dots. They allege absence of policies, but they don't try to connect any kind of absence of policy here to what actually happened. That, you know, of course, the very tragic, horrific killing of Ms. Garay. Just to follow up on some of the discussion with Mr. Scott, a couple times during the argument, comments were made that an allegation is made in this case that the county and CAPMC sent Ms. Garay to the clinic. That is not alleged, and it didn't happen. She had an appointment, and they assisted in some unspecified way her getting there. They're not even specific enough to say that they actually drove them, although they did say it was an unmarked or it was a marked vehicle or something like that. But I wanted to be clear, this was not arranged by the county and CAPMC, this medical appointment.
Did they help her secure that appointment?
Secure it in the sense of making it? I don't know. That's not alleged in the complaint. What is alleged in the complaint is that they assisted getting her to the appointment. So that's all we know is from the First Amendment complaint and what it alleges there, which is, of course, so vague that we have no idea what it is we supposedly did or who supposedly did it, because it doesn't identify that it was the county or CAPMC. They're different entities. CAPMC is a private entity. The county, obviously, a governmental entity. But there has to be at least be some allegation with specificity enough to be able to differentiate and say, well, who was it who did it? Because right now it just says they both did it in some unspecified way. But I wanted to make sure that it wasn't, the court is not under the impression that this was some sort of compulsory medical appointment that the shelter needed her to go to. That isn't what happened here, and that's not what it's alleged.
If they had alleged that the CAPMC knew that the appointment information had been given to her former husband and nevertheless drove her to the appointment, would that be enough to satisfy the rare case under Connick to show deliberate indifference?
I would say only if there are specific enough factual allegations to support that, because under Twombly and Iqbal, of course, they would have to allege sufficient facts from which a reasonable inference could have been drawn that they knew Julio Garay was going to be at the site that day. But just alleging that as a conclusion would not be sufficient, so that would not get them there. And in fact, on the specific issue of knowledge, Iqbal specifically addressed that, because in that case, there was an allegation that Ashcroft and Mueller knew that the subordinates, the underlings, were depriving detainees of constitutional rights and did nothing and basically condoned it, that type of thing. And the Supreme Court, of course, in that case, said that bare allegation of knowledge was insufficient to meet the plausibility standards. There has to be some factual indication of how it was they knew and what they specifically did or didn't do. So, yes, on the broader sense, yeah, if they knew Julio Garay was going to be there and it was plausible and it was factually supported for a reasonable inference, that would be enough.
And the fact that they said, they do allege this, they do allege that, and this is at ER 231, that the county and CAPMC had actual and constructive knowledge and knew and should have known that Camarena had disclosed private health care information that in the past. That's what they say.
That is what they say, and that's insufficient, because that is a conclusion. And it's all too easy to try to loop a governmental entity in by saying, well, they knew. They knew Camarena was doing this, and what, they drove her there? Because, again, they didn't send her there, and they didn't arrange that appointment in terms of, you know, There could be an implication, for example, that the shelter needs all women who go there to have a medical appointment of some sort. That none of that is alleged, and none of that's here. But just the bare allegation, they knew that Camarena does this. They disclose patient information.
Whether they had disclosed to Julio in particular.
And that they disclosed to Julio in particular is a conclusion. There would have to be some kind of factual allegation for how that came about, because especially under the plausibility standard, because and this is repeating an argument that we made in the brief, but it is completely implausible that the county and CAPMC haven't taken all the steps that they did to keep her in a location that was unknown to Julio Garay, then voluntarily, knowingly, willingly took her to a place where they knew he was going to be. It's completely implausible. So when it, on its face, it is completely implausible. That would certainly require, under Twombly and Iqbal, that the complaint allege sufficient facts for how it was that, despite having taken all those measures, they then completely ignored them and willingly exposed her.
Well, it seems like there would be a missing link in that anyway. I mean, even if they knew that the appointment information had been given to the husband, that there's still a step that they would, I would think, they'd need to allege that, and they therefore knew he would be there waiting for her. I mean, he may have been at work that day, may have gone on a trip, we don't know.
That's exactly right. They would have to have alleged plausibly, factually, that they knew that he was going to be there, that he had been told of the appointment, because he would have to be there at the right time and know exactly when she was going in there. So, yeah, that would have to be alleged, but there would have to be sufficient facts, especially when, on its face, the plausibility is really on the lines of the plausibility the Supreme Court rejected in the Iqbal case. So this is a dramatic allegation that the Attorney General of the United States and the FBI director did these bad things. You got to allege more than just a conclusion that they knew and didn't do anything about it, and that they intended it to be discriminatory. Going back to Iqbal, when it alleges something that, on the other facts alleged, makes it roundly implausible that they did what they did, that would certainly, in our position, raise a special duty to have to allege those plausibility facts in a sufficient way to lead to a reasonable inference that they basically just ignored everything they'd done right up to that point. On the issue of policy, and Mr. Scott said, well, what we're alleging here is the absence of a policy. Well, that is true. They have not alleged any affirmative policy, no express policy. They get at the idea of a custom and practice type policy by alleging, as the panel pointed out to Mr. Scott, that there were prior incidents and that allegedly the county and CAPMC did nothing to institute a policy that would actually have put safety measures in place that could have prevented this killing. There are no such prior. I'm sorry. What?
You're actually over time.
Oh, I'm sorry. I appreciate that, Your Honors. And if there's nothing further, I'll turn it over to
thank you,
Mr. Rappaport. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Gaspar Rappaport with Horvitz & Levy on behalf of Community Action Partnership of Madera County, Inc., which I will refer to as CAPMC. So may it please the court, let me just introduce, so you've heard from the council from the County of Madera, and let me tell you about CAPMC very briefly. It's a private non-profit organization that provides charitable services to the community, including, as alleged in the complaint, services to victims of domestic violence. I just want to hit a few points that were asked by this panel. First, with respect to knowledge, there's no factual allegation, plausible factual allegation, of knowledge by CAPMC of a disclosure by a third party, Camarena Health, of that medical appointment on that day. As the court knows, there has to be some factual basis from which the court can draw a reasonable inference of knowledge. Now, to contrast this lack of an allegation regarding knowledge to other allegations of knowledge in the complaint, there are allegations that CAPMC knew about the history of abuse. That is properly alleged in the complaint. And I think that this is a nice contrast to the lack of allegations of any knowledge that CAPMC had about a specific risk of harm that Ms. Garay was going to face on that day when she went to a medical appointment. The opposing counsel referred to the Kennedy case with respect to foreseeability. I think it's important to understand the scope, this very narrow scope of the state-created danger claim, which is an exception to the general rule that when there's a case of private violence, the failure to act by the state does not give rise to a violation of substantive due process. There are obviously a couple of exceptions to that, but the exception that is relevant in this case is state-created danger. There has to be an affirmative act that either creates or increases the risk of harm to a plaintiff, and that risk of harm has to be known or obvious to the defendant, and then the defendant has to ignore the risk and intentionally expose the plaintiff to that risk of harm. Because of the lack of knowledge here, there's really no allegation that CAPMC acted in a deliberate, indifferent way to the safety of Ms. Garay.
I was confused as to why the district court found that CAPMC was a state actor. What's your position on that?
So, and let me preface this answer to your question with the awkwardness that we have in this case of the assertion of a claim that is, based on our research, has only been asserted against law enforcement officers, clear state actors, to a private entity that is that receives funding. So that's an allegation that is properly alleged in the complaint, that administers some programs that are through contracts with the county. An organization that has in its governance, right? So I think it's alleged that about a third of the board of the that governs CAPMC is appointed by the county. But none of these allegations by themselves suffice to show that CAPMC is a state actor. And very importantly, there are no allegations that the specific conduct that is alleged as to CAPMC was intimately intertwined with the conduct of the county, which is what this court requires.
To find that the non-governmental entity is a state actor?
Right.
Okay.
So the conduct that just to...
But if we agree with you that the plaintiffs have failed to allege a constitutional claim or violation, then do we even need to address this issue about CAPMC's being a state actor?
The court could reach could affirm by either going to the merits of the constitutional violation or finding that we are not as there's insufficient allegations that we are a state actor. With respect to the lack of policy, the only thing that is alleged in the complaint is that there was a lack of policy to guard against disclosure of confidential information. Even if that were properly alleged, the problem with that allegation is that CAPMC did not disclose anything. So even if it had a policy, or even if its policies were insufficient to guard against disclosure of confidential information, the problem here is the disclosure by a third party. Is the allegation then that CAPMC should have had a policy to guard against disclosure by third parties? That's just implausible. So there's definitely not sufficient allegations to allege a policy here. Judge Nguyen asked about discovery, and discovery is perfectly appropriate under the rules of civil procedure to substantiate claims that are properly alleged. Discovery is not meant to find new claims to assert against a party. So that would be our position here. I think I covered everything I needed to cover. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Doesn't appear that we do. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think you've got a little bit of time left, counsel.
I don't know that I have anything to add, Your Honor, but I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments this morning. The matter is submitted, and that concludes our argument calendar for this morning. So we'll stand in recess until tomorrow.
All rise. This court for this session stands adjourned.